Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to introduce our keynote speaker for today's symposium. Before I do that, there's a couple of housekeeping items I should have mentioned this morning. The first is, if you are here and hoping to obtain continuing legal education credit, there are flyers around on tables. There is a QR code. You need to scan it and provide some information, and then I think you probably need to scan it again to check out so you can make sure that you get credit from your bar for having attended. The second thing I should mention is, as I said this morning, this is sponsored by the International National Security Law Practice Group for the Federalist Society. We do programs like this and on topics like this throughout the year. And if you have an interest in this kind of programming or you're interested in getting involved with the practice group, you're welcome to come see me at any point during the day or touch base with any of the Federalist Society staff members, and they will get you connected to me and the relevant people. So with that out of the way, it is my privilege to introduce today's keynote speaker, Professor Elliot Cohen. Professor Cohen is the Robert E. Osgood Professor at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies, known far and wide as SAIS, and he's taught there since 1990. He also served as the dean of that school from 2019 to 2021, and he is also transitioning from SAIS to the Center for Strategic International Studies, where he will be the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy. Beyond Professor Cohen's academic credentials, he is an author. His most recent book is titled The Hollow Crown, Shakespeare on How Leaders Rise, Rule, and Fall. And he's written a number of other books that you can find in his bio. In addition, he's had a distinguished career in public service. He spent time at the Department of Defense, and from 2007 to 2009, he was the counselor of the Department of State. He also writes frequently for major newspapers and other periodicals. With that, it's my pleasure to call Professor Cohen up to the dais. Professor Cohen will make comments, and then at the end of his comments, we'll probably have 5 to 8 minutes of Q&A if you're interested. So, Professor Cohen, welcome. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here. I've never actually been to a gathering of the Federalist Society. I sort of expected to see a bunch of people in black capes with kind of big black hats and riding crops, but that's not what you look like, so that means I can't trust the Washington Post as much as I used to. I should also point out that I was counselor of the Department of State. I was therefore frequently confused with the legal advisor, John Bellinger. It was a source of mirth for both of us. So the question that was posed, that I was asked to address, is can America remain a global power? And it is a question that is posed and that would not have been asked, I think, until the last decade or so. Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping think they know the answer, that the United States should not, may not, and with a good hard push or two, will not be a global power. They may believe that the United States will remain relatively rich, but it'll be just one player in a multipolar world and may not even be supreme in its own hemisphere, let alone Asia or Europe. It's a question that is increasingly asked by some, even of our closest friends, and it's a question we ask ourselves. A friend of mine wrote a fine book called The Weary Titan, about Britain at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, as its period of hegemony ended. And it's not irresponsible to ask whether the United States, too, is a weary titan, although of a different type. Having said that, I think the question needs to be qualified. The United States will remain a global power. The question is, what kind of global power? We'll remain a global power because we have always been one. Let's begin at the beginning. You know, we talk about World War I and World War II, but actually World War II was World War VIII. There have been 8 global conflicts, beginning with the 9 Years' War, which in the American colonies was known as King William's War, the War of the Spanish Succession, which was known in the American colonies as Queen Anne's War, the War of the Austrian Succession, King George's War, the 7 Years' War, French and Indian War here, the War of American Independence, which let us remember became a global conflict, the Napoleonic Wars, which included the War of 1812. Even in those earliest periods, even before independence, we see the curious combination of American ideals and interests shaping our foreign policy and our willingness to project power globally to do so. On February 16, 1815, the United States Senate ratified the Treaty of Ghent, ending the War of 1812. The next month, it voted enthusiastically to declare war on Algiers. President Madison, equally enthusiastically, sent virtually the entire United States Navy across the Atlantic to wage it, and as it did so, to secure the freedom not only of American prisoners held by the Barbary powers, but Europeans as well. It's not until the 20th century that politicians thought, though, that the United States had to have a global role. Under Theodore Roosevelt, the United States arbitrated the end of the Russo-Japanese War, projected power into the Pacific, definitively warned European powers off of Latin American interventions, committed to a variety of smaller uses of force internationally, including in China and the Middle East, and, of course, famously sent the Great White Fleet around the world on a 1.5-year cruise. Still, the United States at that period was one of the world's major powers and far from having the largest military. The American intervention in the First World War marked a decisive commitment of power by the United States, as did our shaping of the Great Versailles Peace Settlement, even though the United States subsequently stepped back from international commitments. Still, the legacies of that period were enormous as well, including the rise of the United States to global financial parity, financial and naval parity, and more than parity, with the greatest power, Great Britain. And of course, I haven't spoken about our deep international economic ties, the American role in the opening of Japan to the outside world, at the point of a gun, it has to be said, and in China, or our various Latin American adventures. We've been a global power for a long, long time, and there's no reason to think that that will end. Pure isolation from the world, then, has always been an absurdity. It's contrary to our economic interests, which are global, contrary to our security interests, because after the one period of serious isolationism, we paid a very heavy price for that, and contrary to our values, which are universalistic in nature. Any country whose founding documents include the statement that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights cannot be isolationist. I'll return to that point later on. But there's another reason we have to remain a world power, and that has to do with the profound interconnectedness of the world and our interests and values in it. This past year, my first real year free of teaching in many, I've traveled to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, among other places, two war zones and one flashpoint. What struck me particularly forcibly is the way in which these places are connected to each other. In Taiwan, I met with President Tsai, and her senior colleagues. All of them insisted that if the United States had to delay some of the shipments of arms to Taiwan, arms that they have paid for, in order to send them to Ukraine, that was fine with them and a good idea too. In Israel, a belated recognition that Russia has thrown in its lot with Iran and will help it at Israel's and our expense. Ukraine, which has suffered under a shower not only of Iranian drones, but from Russian missiles and bombs, which are increasingly filled with Chinese components. It's no coincidence, by the way, that our European allies are taking an increasingly tough line on China, and that their line on Iran is, in fact, at the moment, even tougher than ours. Here's the hard fact. There are four countries in the world, at least, whose governments are our avowed enemies, and I do mean enemies, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. They intend to drive us from large swaths of the world and certainly depose us as the predominant power in the globe. They support one another in a variety of endeavors, including the waging of war against American allies and partners, the suppression of even moderate dissent, and the development and production of major weapon systems. In addition, they wage a relentless war of subversion against us in what is sometimes called the Global South, but also in our very own country. And their relationships have become increasingly close. They are, moreover, increasingly willing to do all these things openly and brazenly, to include using means like the kidnapping of American citizens, sabotage, and even murder. That's a pretty dark picture, but it's essential, I think, to see it for what it is. And please note, I've not mentioned the non-state forces that are equally our enemies, the various jihadist elements that are not consistently aligned with China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, but occasionally are, and that have been contained but not destroyed. The question then is what kind of global power we intend to be. And here there is real debate. I think I would put the basic schools in three groups. The first are the so-called restrainers, who may be relied upon to oppose any American action, and particularly military action, abroad. They have yet to control policy, but they influenced it during the Obama administration and perhaps to a lesser extent during the Trump administration. By and large, they are also a group that describes themselves as realists, which is merely, of course, a form of semantic sleight of hand. After all, who wants to be an unrealist? But in practice, what that means is they think taking American values seriously in foreign policy is, at best, foolhardy. But there is a reason why Lincoln cast the Civil War in universal terms, a test whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. American values have a universal quality to them, which is why student demonstrators in Tiananmen Square in 1989 put up a papier-mâché model of the Statue of Liberty. The restrainers like to quote selectively from John Quincy Adams' July 4th address in 1821 to the effect that the United States goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. They ignore Adams' own experience as the diplomat who shaped a peace settlement in 1814 that ultimately doomed Native Americans to be subjected to the United States government, who was the real author of the Monroe Doctrine, and who was a resolute expansionist. And they also ignore his belief that the United States would, and I quote from that same speech, stand and must forever stand alone, a beacon on the summit of the mountain to which all the inhabitants of the earth may turn their eyes for a genial and saving light till time shall be lost in eternity and this globe itself dissolve, nor leave a rack behind. That doesn't sound like John Mearsheimer to me. A values dimension is hardwired into American foreign policy, and that is why American Micro Metternichs and Tinhorn Talleyrands are always likely to feel frustrated. Moreover, the restrainers have found it difficult, or indeed impossible, to come up with a positive vision of foreign policy. They know what they are against, but they do not know what they are for. They may not be pacifists, but they are definitely passivists. That is to say, they favor the kind of foreign policy famously described by Lord Salisbury as drifting downstream and periodically sticking out a diplomatic boat hook to fend off collisions. And by the way, that policy collapsed about a decade after he made those remarks in the wake of the Boer War. And where I find their arguments disingenuous is in their failure to describe what happens when we don't act, because a decision not to act, after all, is still a decision and a consequential one. The Obama administration famously decided that the first rule of foreign policy was don't do stupid stuff. As a result, it gave Russia undeserved wins in Syria and Crimea, found itself compelled against its wishes to re-enter the Iraq War, and concluded a flawed treaty with Iran, which would only have deferred its acquisition of real nuclear potential, a development which unfortunately is now upon us. Let me add that it was even more reluctant to arm Ukraine than the Trump administration, and thereby helped set the preconditions for the Russian invasion of 2022. A second school of thought is that of primacy to the Indo-Pacific. This is sometimes associated with the Trump administration, although the fact is that the Biden administration entered with the same view, and even the Obama administration towards the end was there as well. For sure, the prevailing desire, particularly in the current administration, has been to get the hell out of the Middle East and park European security concerns to one side so that we can focus on containing China. It sounds very grand strategic, but to paraphrase the famous statement about everybody having a plan in a boxing match until they get punched in the face, everybody has a grand strategy until Russia invades Ukraine. In retrospect, the one place from which we did disengage dramatically in recent times is Afghanistan, and that was a political, human, and moral catastrophe, which had long-term consequences for our credibility, as well as for the lives of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Afghans who had thrown their lot in with us. The fact is that we have not been able even to disengage from the Middle East because, again, to paraphrase a famous saying, you may not be interested in the Middle East, but the Middle East is most definitely interested in you. Or better yet, unlike Las Vegas, what happens in the Middle East does not stay in the Middle East. The Trump administration, despite its sincere wishes, could not get out of Syria or Iraq and ended up killing a top Iranian general in Baghdad. And the Biden administration, too, finds that it as well, however reluctantly, has to engage in the use of military power in the Middle East. In fact, in short, the fact of interconnectedness makes globalists of us all. I was speaking once to the head of Australian intelligence who was explaining why he thought it was urgently important for his country to be involved in supporting Ukraine in the current war. I said, how do you explain that to the Australian people? He said, look, our country has only faced an existential threat once in 1942, and that was because the Asian Security Order broke down. And the Asian Security Order broke down because the European Security Order had broken down. All this should not entirely surprise us, because it is also the enduring lesson of the last century. Above all, it should force us to reflect on the most monumental creation of American statecraft, the creation of an American-led world order. And I use that phrase rather than a rules-based order or even a liberal international order for reasons that will become clear. The American world order commenced at the end of World War II and the early Cold War. In some respects, we are still living in the world that Franklin Roosevelt and his partners and advisors created. And it's worth reflecting on what were the core beliefs that shaped the way they in turn devised that world order. And I think you can boil down their principles, and when I say they, I mean Roosevelt, his advisors, congressional leaders, including congressional Republicans, some of whom had originally been isolationists. So five propositions. First, that totalitarianism was the chief cause of the ruin of World War II. We can't understand Americans' staunch opposition to communism if we don't understand equally the belief, largely correct, that at its core it had a lot in common with Nazism. Secondly, was the belief that totalitarian ideologies could only grow in the conditions of political and economic chaos, the conditions that were created by the aftermath of World War I and a poor settlement at the end of it. Thirdly, that the underlying reasons for that chaos, for the horrors of World War I and its aftermath, were the untrammeled competition for power among the great empires before World War I and America's withdrawal from international politics. Fourth, their belief, in retrospect obvious, that their war was the most devastating conflict ever experienced by humanity, and that another war similar to it could literally bring the end of human civilization. And finally, they feared that that war would not necessarily be the last unless someone did something about it. In other words, they did not believe in the automatic functioning of the international system, as do some political scientists. These beliefs were essentially correct. From those beliefs came a set of core remedies that the United States would have to accept for the indefinite future a position of international leadership, because only it had the combination of wealth, military power, and ideological appeal to deal with the post-war world. They would have to confront totalitarian ideologies and be inclined to see them, rather than nationalism or state interest, as the prime driver of international politics. that the solution to economic chaos would have to be an open trading order rather than the division of the world into separate blocks. And that would also mean maintaining such fundamental requirements as the freedom of the seas and transparent and reliable financial systems. It also meant the destruction of the European overseas empires, which were in any event tottering. The solution to political chaos would be an assertive American role. Those solutions in turn required new, strong international institutions led by the United States. The IMF and the World Bank, created at Bretton Woods in 1944, standing peacetime alliances like NATO in 1949, and of course the United Nations itself, founded in 1945 in San Francisco. Note all of those institutions founded in the United States. And from 1945 onwards, the founding generation brooded over the problem of nuclear weapons. American leaders were not quite sure how to use them in international politics, but it soon became an article of faith that it would be essential to limit their spread and prevent their use. Now, these building blocks were new, and they were not inevitable. They required Americans to leave behind their aversion to permanent international arrangements, to surrender some elements or modify some elements of sovereignty, to create large standing military organizations for the first time in the history of our republic, to step away from the tariffs that had been a cornerstone of American industrial policy in the early republic, and to think ideologically and not simply pragmatically. Put together, this was the American world order. It did not cover the entire globe. The Soviet Union and its allies were out of it. It was not universally popular. Important neutrals like India did not like it. It was not entirely successful. New nuclear states have continued to emerge. But it has proved astonishingly resilient and effective. And I think it's important to remind ourselves of the scope of change that it successfully managed. There were something like 70 independent states in the world after World War II. Today, there are three times as many. Real world GDP has grown by over an order of magnitude. Even accounting for population growth, that's still a quintupling of per person GDP. It's an amazing record. Now, it came with costs. American willingness to tolerate trade deficits, to sustain a large military, to push and prod our allies into decolonization, but we benefited from it as well. In the last 50 years alone, for example, American per capita GDP has considerably more than tripled. Well, all very well. So why is the question of the American world order now in play? One answer has to do with the stretch the United States is feeling. Global leadership was never easy, but it is, relatively speaking, much more difficult than before. Immediately after World War II, the United States accounted for roughly half of the world's economy, which is quite astonishing. Even in the mid-1960s, it was well over a third of global GDP. Today, we produce a bit less than a quarter of global GDP. We are working from a more slender military base as well. From nearly half the world's military spending in the 1960s through the 1980s to roughly a third today. Americans in general, it is fair to say, feel stretched. They don't always see the point of continuing to bear burdens on behalf of others, and they do not always see the payoff to themselves. Moreover, there's another point. Much of the rationale for the American global position, and particularly its global military position, was cast in terms of the Cold War. When that conflict ended in 1989, there should have been a fundamental reconsideration of its premises, and that didn't happen. The 1990s were what my late colleague Fuad Ajmi called the Great Picnic, during which being a superpower was cheap and easy and to some extent enjoyable. Other countries, after all, paid for the first Gulf War. We made a modest profit off it. It cost us fewer than 150 soldiers killed in action. More were killed in accidents. A debate might have been triggered in the 2000s, but instead, after 9/11, that was the era of the great emergency. And so here we are, after several administrations that have demonstrated no great talent in the conduct of foreign policy, and have found it difficult to articulate a vision for a post-Cold War world that still desperately needs American leadership. My view is that That order, or rather a modified version of it, is still worth us attempting to uphold. More specifically, we should seek to maintain an environment favorable to freedom and the rule of law, if only because free and law-abiding states are much less likely to fear and threaten our own free institutions. We should seek to limit, because we cannot stop, the rise of powers that are fundamentally hostile to us and to that order, force them to pay heavily and disproportionately for attempts to conquer their neighbors, and by nonviolent means facilitate their internal change. And thirdly, we need to sustain a trade and financial regime favorable to general prosperity while mitigating as much as possible global risks, particularly those from climate change. That will all be very difficult. As of now, the American world order exists, but it is creaking. There are fractures. And as I said at the beginning, there's reason to think that it may not last. Instead of totalitarianism, as we faced in the 20th century, we have other movements, religious fanaticism, nationalism, and populism, all increasingly powerful. In a China that is not merely rising, but that it has in many ways already arrived, we have a country whose economic dynamism matches our own. Russia, to a degree that we would not have anticipated a decade ago, is attempting with extraordinary violence to reestablish its imperial past while destroying the European security order. Other states, particularly Iran, are also using force to reshape the politics of their regions. We have an economic order in which commitment to free trade on the part of the United States is certainly weaker. But it's also fair to say that there are elements of that economic order that are less transparent and predictable than once they were, whether because of new mediums of exchange like Bitcoin, or the way in which money can pour in and out of countries with astonishing speed. The end of empire has not brought stability in many parts of the world, and in fact, the artificiality and compromises required to create new states such as Syria or Iraq or Yugoslavia have led to further conflict, while secessionist movements in a number of countries, including in Europe, have grown rather than shrunk in strength. Nuclear weapons have been limited by a variety of efforts, but as we see from the cases of North Korea and Iran, they are now spreading beyond the great powers and relatively reliable emerging powers like India and Israel. International institutions no longer have the vigor and moral authority they once had. Neither, more ominously, do many institutions indispensable to self-government and the rule of law. A redefinition of the American role in the world is yet to be born. It will not simply be that of, say, the year 2000. Too much has happened. China and Russia invested for decades in their own military strength, while we were suffering our own disappointments abroad. Amazing new technologies are disrupting our politics, our economics, and our societies. But I'm quite confident that one can emerge. Hammering out that conception is work that needs to begin now in many fora, including this one. And there are reasons to be hopeful. The United States has, in absolute hands, a very good hand to play, in absolute terms, a very good hand to play in international politics. It is, in relative terms, however, a weakening one. There remains nothing to beat the American alliance system, but alliances are, as George Shultz once said, like gardens. They need continuous tending. The American military is the strongest on earth, but is in some respects calcified, weakened as much as it has been strengthened by its vast experience of recent war. The American economy is dynamic and still the most innovative on earth and is aided by the abundance of American energy and water resources, but it rests on an infrastructure of roads and railroads and airports that is increasingly inadequate. American demography is better than that of any other country, most definitely including China. But for a time at least, that American ability to integrate waves of aspiring newcomers, as my grandparents were, is challenged. American research institutions are superb, but the freedom of thought and expression on our campuses is not once what it once was. American values and ideals remain popular, but the institutions of political warfare with which we made the case for them and spread them aggressively around the world, think of the U.S. Information Agency, Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, need to be overhauled or in some cases reinvented. The bottom line is that our hand is weaker than it once was, but what remains in our grasp is the opportunity to strengthen it again. None of these challenges is insuperable, but they require a kind of calculated statecraft which has been lacking and a national consensus which is now in danger. We need an adroitness, a decisiveness, and a vision that have been lacking at the top of our most recent administrations, and we need an unsparing audit of our decision-making institutions. The end of the Cold War bred a complacency, which on top of American self-confidence, some might say arrogance, has not served us well. We need a new generation of statesmen and leaders, perhaps some of them in this room for all I know, of the stature of an Acheson or a Schultz or a Schlesinger, politicians who take inspiration from a Kennedy or a Reagan, thoughtful soldiers and sailors like Goodpaster or Burke, historians and religious thinkers like Pipes and Niebuhr, and many more. Let us remember that we have opportunities, too. The rise of more or less friendly great powers like India, the internal pressures that are felt by our enemies, the power of the internet to mobilize populations in constructive as well as destructive ways, all give us a lot of material to work with. But if we fail to rise to that challenge, we risk a lot. And although I would rather conclude on an optimistic note, I think it's important to remind ourselves of what is at stake. If we do not secure Ukraine and Taiwan in particular, we will see terrible human tragedies as freedom-loving peoples are slaughtered or subjugated, our alliances weakened, and our strategic position damaged almost beyond repair. Even worse, in such a case, we will soon find ourselves in the midst of a spread of nuclear weapons, the likes of which we have never seen. Should our allies and partners doubt our strength and our commitment to them, states like Finland, Poland, Ukraine itself, Kazakhstan, Japan, South Korea, and even Indonesia and Australia will think hard about acquiring such weapons. They would be right to do so, and by the way, some of them already are. A world of small nuclear arsenals is a world that invites nuclear preemption. The movie Oppenheimer is very good entertainment, although it's not great history. But it will hopefully remind many people of just how destructive these weapons are, something we have not thought about in quite a while. A world in which freedom of the seas, the most fundamental requirement of international commerce, is no longer guaranteed by the dominant maritime power, is a world in which a lot of the global economy will be at risk, to include the information order that relies on underwater cables. The same goes for space. And if the seas and space become realms of chaos, global prosperity will be a thing of the past. A world in which aggressor states, some of them like Russia, which can and should be described as essentially fascistic, can routinely subvert and overthrow governments friendly to us, will be a world that will suddenly shrink around the United States, and which, as indeed to some extent is already happening, we will have to defend ourselves at home from foreign attempts to manipulate us and undermine our system of government. A world in which Russia thinks that it can attack Estonia or Lithuania, and China thinks that it can seize Taiwan, and both without meeting an American response, is a world that might very easily slip into a global conflict, a conflict that would be just as terrible and perhaps more terrible than the Second World War. The fact is, we are in a period analogous to the 1930s. This time, however, we have the opportunity to do something to avoid the destruction that followed a period of fecklessness and indecision by the democracies. The epigraph to the final volume of Winston Churchill's World War II memoir is how the great democracies triumphed, and so were able to resume the follies which had so nearly cost them their life. It's a warning that still stands. Three times in the last century, the democracies triumphed at terrible cost and indeed resumed those follies. Let's hope that we don't go through it all a fourth time. Thank you very much. Happy to take any questions or comments you might have. Yeah, in the back there.
Thank you, Professor Cohen. Stephen Taft here. So I think it's not really a secret at this point that many on the right in this country don't no longer just look at these issues from the standpoint of isolation or reacting to things, but maybe even see a dialectic conflict between left and right transposed in different regions and countries throughout the world, which perhaps for some, not all, even leads to some allowances for the Putin regime and focusing hostility on, say, the EU and its institutions more so. Now, I'm wondering, leaving aside the legitimacy of those views, if any, what is your take, sir, on what a Russian victory in Ukraine would have in terms of impact on those values, you could say, that those people hold? Would it actually help what they want, or are there ways that you could make the case to them that perhaps they should also favor a Ukrainian victory?
Well, the first thing is that you can't ignore the validity of what they have to say, and you have to force them to look at the Putin regime and what it does, at the prison camps, at the assassinations, at the brutality of that invasion. You know, one thing that really struck me, I've now visited Ukraine a number of times, as struck me when I was in Israel too. Both the Russian army and Hamas very deliberately use sexual violence as a way of intimidating and subjugating a civilian population. This was not troops slipping out of control. This was deliberate. And I believe, and whenever I speak now, I mention that point, and I rub people's noses in it because, you know, facile remarks, not that you made them, you didn't, about, you know, is there possibly a case to be said for Putin? Remember, this is a guy who very deliberately and cold-bloodedly unleashed mass rape as a tool of war. So the fact is you're dealing with a regime which is truly evil by any reasonable definition. I think the consensus would be if Russia somehow does manage to defeat Ukraine, all you need to do is point to Putin's writings. It's very clear that he does not think that the Baltic states have a legitimate existence as independent states or as members of NATO. And I can tell you, I just came back from Estonia. If you talk to not just leaders of the Baltic states, but countries like Finland or the Czech Republic, or Sweden, they take the possibility of a follow-on war extremely seriously in ways that Americans don't. But as I said, I think that, you know, the way you have to go after this is really be very detailed with people about this is what these people do. And, you know, we've had these sorts of arguments before. I mean, people could say, look, you know, isn't Monsieur Blum a terrible premier of France, and look what the socialists are doing to that country. And that cannot in no way justify any kind of moral equivalence with Hitler, and it doesn't excuse a failure to see Hitler for what he was. And we're not dealing quite with a Hitler, but we're dealing with somebody who's very, very bad and has really malign intent. Yeah.
I was struck by thank you for your remarks. One comment you made was that we're facing four countries that are enemies. They're North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China. And I was struck by the fact that China, unlike Russia, where we have almost no economic relationship, Iran, we have no economic and then China is our number three trading partner and deeply intertwined with our economy. Isn't one really very different from the other? How would you separate that group out? I mean, a lot of people say the first three, yes. Are you sure we're ready to count China as the enemy? If we are we, isn't the right way to think about the Cold War with China rather than trying to create an American-led border?
So obviously you have to make a distinction between a government and its people. Although you can go too far on that one. You know, there's a point where the people are entirely complicit with what the government is doing or actually approve of it. But again, I don't think it always strikes me, people don't read speeches. If you read the speeches that Xi Jinping or senior Chinese military leaders or senior officials in the defense and national security establishment make, it's very clear they think of us as the enemy. And they articulate that. We do trade a lot with them. Americans have a long tradition of trading with the enemy. I mean, it usually doesn't end up all that well. You know, Ford was doing a booming business in Germany. For that matter, we did a booming business with the British during the War of 1812. I mean, that happens all the time. But I think people are making a big mistake if they underestimate the fundamental hostility of the Chinese government to us and the desire to drive us out of that part of the world. Now, you know, I think Xi is a more calculating figure than Vladimir Putin, so I think he's restrained by the fact that he has other interests, including not wanting to, you know, torpedo his own economy. But in terms of the basic intent and outlook of the regime, it's a perfectly appropriate characterization. And I think one of the reasons to use it is because it shocks people a little bit. And it should shock people a bit, but it's the truth. And like I said, all you have to do is read their writings. Yep.
So if they're the enemy, why are we trading so much?
Well, first, as a practical matter, I don't think you actually can. But the truth is, this administration is following. You know, as an outsider, it's always very amusing to watch one administration denouncing its predecessors and then doing exactly the same thing. And the Biden administration is basically following the same lines as the Trump administration in terms of cutting back trade in a large number of areas. It's one of the things that I think is very difficult to square with traditional American statecraft. I don't think we believe in an open trading order in the same way that we used to, and I'm afraid I'm not even sure that I believe that we should. I mean, it was a good thing that we had no interest in trading with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had no interest in trading with us right after World War II. Now there's plenty of interest on it and on both sides. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, the lady over here.
The lady over there.
Okay.
Well, thanks for your remarks. I'm curious how you would counsel the U.S. to respond to the ICJ and the ICC actions, which are basically, I think, contrary to what our positioning has been on the Israeli-Gaza conflict, and what do you think we'll actually do?
Yeah. Well, you know, it reinforces all the beliefs that I had, which I learned at the knee of Jeremy Rabkin, that, terrible, terrible idea for us to be part of that system. And it was a system that's intrinsically vulnerable to politics by another means. And I think, you know, then this, of course, we're a society, you know, some of the federal society can play an important role in sort of explaining to people why. I mean, when you say an international criminal court that, you know, throws Slobodan Milosevic in jail, that sounds like a very good thing. Who would be against that? And I do think it requires some serious effort at public education to make it clear that, you know, it's different when you have a sovereign and when you're in a world without a sovereign. And when you look at the mechanics of who gets to be a justice and how cases are adjudicated and all that. And I don't think we'll back down from that. This administration has been particularly inept at is, in the case of Israel and Gaza, is being very forthright in explaining why it is that you're going to see lots of terrible things happening in Gaza, because you're fighting war in a really dense urban environment. And, you know, when we did that, same thing happened. The city of Aachen, lovely German town, was 80% of it rubble by the time we liberated it. We liberated Manila in February of 1945. 100,000 Filipinos died during that. We killed God knows how many Germans and Japanese civilians during the war. I mean, I think one of the deeper problems our country has is we have not, and you see this reflected in how we deal with the Ukrainians, we have not fought a war of that intensity and seriousness since World War II. And we have not fought a truly existential war since the Civil War. Israel and Ukraine are both fighting existential wars. And part of the function of political leadership, I think, in this circumstance should be to, A, explain to people what an existential war really means and how it's very different from things we've experienced, but also what the realities of warfare are, which are very remote from not only from average Americans, but from the kinds of people who write the president's speeches. Yes, ma'am.
I want to drill down on just one part of your comments, which is the reference to climate change, which you seem to be putting in the context of a worthwhile objective that had to be balanced with defense. My understanding of countries in competition is that generally the country with the cheapest and most plentiful source of energy wins, as long as it also has other accoutrements of great power status. Now, China goes forward with coal, with nuclear, with whatever is convenient for them to build up what they need, as well as getting energy from Iran and Russia. In the United States, very complicated to see what the hell we're doing with this. And there is very little understanding of the fact that most of the carbon problems of the world are coming from China and they're not coming from us, and there isn't much that we could do to alleviate this. So would you care to tailor that remark along the lines that the aggressive climate change agenda is actually something that is getting in the way of dealing with this global situation, which we ought to be taking more seriously than we are?
I don't think it gets in the way. I think it's a false trade-off. I do think the right, and I should have stipulated at the beginning, I'm a conservative, which also happens to be why I'm no longer a Republican. Makes a big mistake when it denies that climate change is happening and that it has potentially catastrophic consequences for a number of countries, and that those catastrophic consequences will then turn into security issues. If you have large swaths of the earth which become unlivable, those people are going to move. And that's one good way to get yourself into substantial war. So we have to care about it. Does that mean that, you know, government edict should require everybody to buy their cars from Elon Musk? No. But does it mean that it has to be an issue that we think about seriously? Yes. And I think because conservatives have failed to take the issue seriously, they completely left it on the table for the other side to frame the agenda. In the same way that I think how did you get Obamacare? Well, one of the reasons why is I don't think conservatives particularly thought or wished to think about health care as a serious issue. And, you know, there are some reasons for that, but at the end of the day, you do that. If you don't have a view on it, then the other guy's view is the one that, you know, everybody orients around, and you find yourself, you know, moving within some spectrum that they've defined and not you. And I don't think that's where we should be. Yeah, in the back there.
My name is Jerry Cox. I guess you can hear. I'll shout if this isn't working. My name is Jerry Cox. I was legislative counsel for Jack Danforth early in my career, and I did his defense and intelligence work. And that was well before he became the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. So my question is, what do we do with the United Nations at this point? Maybe the same thing he did?
I think... what you have to do is start by having low and reasonable expectations. There are certain things that the United Nations actually can handle pretty well. I mean, things like international postal conventions and things of that sort, which are, and some of the humanitarian things that they do, some of them. And the UN is also, I'll just tell you from my 2 years as a kind of diplomat, just as a meeting place, place where countries can interact and you can conduct diplomacy of a kind. The mistake was always to try to frame it as some sort of quasi-world government, which it is not and cannot and never will be. And here again, I think, you know, there's a mistake in political leaders not trying to explain to the American people what these institutions are good for and what they're not good for and what their uses are and what their limits are. But I think that that's about it. I mean, I don't think that the United Nations can be overhauled in some way that's really going to make sense. At some point, you know, the Security Council makes no sense, but there's no way that you're going to overhaul it with, you know, new vetoes and stuff like that that's going to make any more sense. So I think it's going to become a relic. And that's why I think you need original thinking. I mean, it's not going to be enough. In 1945, you can easily understand why there was a lot invested in the UN. We're no longer in that world. And so the question is, how do you think about some of the same functions that people wanted to see in place with the UN, but that aren't, that can't be fulfilled by it? As I said, it seems to me there's kind of a mix of revitalizing old institutions, but also creating new ones. Lady over here.
Thank you very much for your most interesting presentation. I've really enjoyed it. One issue, though, to me, which has come out during this morning and right now, is that we ought to be putting much greater emphasis on freedom of the individual in the societies in which they live. We ought to explain, because maybe people do not understand, the extent and nature of oppression and the forms that that takes in China, for example. Their use of the central bank digital currency will be to see who spends money on what and whether or not they should be allowed to do so. Yeah. Issues like that, I think, that to get people to appreciate the value of the freedom that we have here and in the West, and to show the extent of the oppression, whether it takes a violent form or in restricting people's activities, their right to believe in their own religious faith, their right to practice it at every level. Those are the real and fundamental values to me, not just innovation and economic growth, but underlying all of that is the freedom of the individual, the freedom of expression. We need to take care that it's not suppressed in any way in this country and in Europe. But that is one of the prime values that we need to express and which we should be committed to defending. Ukraine is not just fighting for its borders. It's fighting for the freedoms which it has learned to acquire and develop in the post-Soviet era.
Yeah. That's eloquent, and I can't really add anything to it because I agree with it. I suppose I would add only one thing. You know, I very deliberately referred to freedom and rule of law, not democracy. I think we made a mistake over the last couple of decades by invoking the word democracy, which doesn't necessarily, as Tocqueville taught us, always imply freedom. And rule of law, which is a topic that should be of importance to this group as well. I think if you have those two, then, you know, do I really care about the extent of suffrage? Probably a lot less. Last question.
Thank you. So you raised the issue of national consensus, and the idea that implies to me the idea that, well, one precondition for us to be a global power would be that there would be a consensus that we should be a global power. And I guess my question is, supposing we're in something like Cold War II, you also pointed out the revitalization of institutions like the U.S. Information Agency and things like that, that in Cold War I sought to influence the domestic views and the culture and a culture of freedom and a culture that's conducive to American values in those Cold War battlegrounds in places like Europe. But it seems to me in Cold War II, we're in that kind of debate. It's not Cold War I Italy. In Cold War II, the cultural debate, the political debate, the social debate is here in America as well. And I'm just getting your take or your sense that this the information, if I'm fairly characterizing it, that the information war in Cold War I was abroad mainly, or we had institutions to deal with it abroad, do we somehow need to have, and there are obviously dangers here, to have an information values battle here in America, because obviously our opponents, our enemies as you call them, are engaged in that kind of action here?
So let me take issue with your characterization of this as Cold War II. This is 1930s II. That's a very different world. The Cold War was essentially stable. I mean, there were possibilities at different times that it could get out of hand. This feels to me much more like sort of mid-30s, where, you know, you have Mussolini invading Abyssinia, 1935, Hitler taking the Rhineland, the Marco Polo Bridge incident in 1937. In each case, Western leaders say, boy, that's terrible. In each case, they do something, you know, vote sanctions on Italy. But they did not, what they did not do in step back and say, we have a much larger and more serious problem that's on our doorsteps. And they don't begin thinking that way really until 38. And I think we're more like that earlier period where there are enough warning indicators that the issue is not Cold War. It's potentially something much worse. And I think that changes things. Secondly, I'm not sure that during Cold War I we had unanimity or anything remotely like it. I have no idea how those early institutions covered race relations in the United States. But boy, if there was ever a fraught issue in the 50s and 60s here in the United States, it would have had to be race relations. And, you know, would you have had something that would have gotten, I forget, you'd have to tell me which political figure I should talk to on the left, or in, you know, somebody like Richard Russell on the right, where they would really agree? I don't think so. So, I don't think the United States can actually walk and chew gum at the same time, and we can have those internal debates, and that's part of our appeal, by the way, I think, that people see that we can have those while we talk about that abroad, and we talk about it candidly. And the final thing I want to say in all this is I think it's a big mistake, which a lot of politicians have made and continue to make, say, well, we have to have consensus before we do something, as opposed to saying, I'm going to shape the consensus. So I wrote a book called The Big Stick, which is about military power in American foreign policy, published about 8 years ago. And it's, of course, from Theodore Roosevelt's famous we should speak softly but carry a big stick. But it's actually, that is actually the least important part of that speech. That speech is mainly about the American role in the world and how much is now expected of us. We have a major role to play. And what's fascinating to me about that speech is where he gave it. He gave it in rural Minnesota to a big country fair. He very deliberately was going into the American heartland, an area which he knew was not particularly interested in international affairs, except insofar as it affected the price of wheat. And he was making the case to the American people there and many, many other places, say, no, you really do have to care about it. And I think that's really the challenge to political leadership today, to get out there and make the case rather than wait, and make the consensus rather than wait for the consensus to come to them. Thank you very much.
We'll pick up with our second panel at about 1:30. Thank you.